StorySwap presents Alliances and Armaments, a framework for students on the structural causes of World War I, 1860s to 1914. Prologue. Imagine a continent at the dawn of the 20th century, seemingly at the height of its power and progress. Europe in the early 1900s boasts advanced industries, expanding empires, and a network of alliances meant to ensure stability. Yet, in the summer of 1914, a single assassination in a distant Balkan city ignites a chain of events that engulfs the world in a war of unprecedented destruction, claiming more than 16 million lives and reshaping societies, borders, and global politics. How does this happen? Why does World War I occur, turning apparent peace into catastrophe? This question lies at the heart of our exploration, a puzzle that reveals not just historical forces, but lessons for understanding conflict in any era. This lecture series is crafted for curious minds like those in an advanced high school history class or an introductory college course, students eager to dig into the complexities of the past without needing prior expertise in European diplomacy. If you're preparing for exams, writing essays, or simply seeking to grasp how nations slide into war, this audio journey will equip you with a clear framework. We'll draw on deep research from diplomatic records, contemporary accounts, and historical debates, presenting the story in a straightforward, evidence-based way. No need for notes or visuals, just listen as we build a mental map together, step by step. We'll start with the long-term foundations that set the stage, examining how nationalism, imperialism, militarism, and shifting alliances create a tense European order from the 1870s onward. From there, we'll zoom in on the crises that make war thinkable, tracing the escalations from Moroccan disputes to the fateful July crisis of 1914. Finally, we'll synthesize the interpretations, weighing structural pressures against human choices, and asking what this means for our world today. Along the way, the tension builds. Were Europe's leaders trapped by inevitable forces, or did their decisions at critical moments seal the fate? Understanding World War I matters now because it shows how interconnected systems, alliances, arms races, and national pride can amplify small sparks into global fires. In an age of rapid communications and fragile balances, reflecting on 1914 helps us navigate modern tensions with wiser eyes. Let's begin this inquiry together, unraveling the causes that transformed a continent and echo through history. End of prologue. At the center of this course stands a deceptively simple question. Why does World War I occur? In the summer of 1914, decisions taken in a few European capitals unleash a conflict that kills more than 16 million people. It turns a continent that has appeared relatively stable into a landscape of unprecedented destruction. Understanding how that happens means looking well beyond the guns of August. It requires a long view of how European politics, societies, and ideas change over the previous half century. This first part focuses on that deeper background. It looks at Europe from roughly the 1860s to 1914. It examines how new nation-states such as Germany and Italy appear, how old multi-ethnic empires struggle with nationalism, how alliances and rivalries harden, how imperial expansion and arms races fuel competition, and how domestic politics and cultural attitudes toward war shape decision-making. The goal is not to retell battle narratives, but to understand the structures and pressures that make a general war possible, and, in the eyes of some leaders, even thinkable. To follow this story, certain key terms need clear and simple definitions. Nationalism is the belief that a people who share a language, culture, or historical experience should have their own political community, usually a state, and that loyalty to that nation should be a primary political value. In the 19th century, nationalism is both a force for creating new, more unified states, such as Italy and Germany, and a force for breaking apart old empires that contain many different peoples. It is a powerful and often emotional idea, and by the early 20th century, it shapes how governments and many citizens think about war and peace. Imperialism is the practice by which powerful states extend their control beyond their existing borders, usually over distant territories and peoples.
This may take the form of direct colonial rule, economic domination, or political influence backed by the threat of force. In the decades before World War I, European powers carve up large parts of Africa and Asia, claiming resources, markets, and strategic bases. This expansion increases their wealth and global reach, but it also creates new rivalries and disputes that feed back into European politics. Another key term is militarism. Militarism is more than just having a strong army or navy. It is a cultural and political attitude that gives the military a special prestige, treats war as a normal or even noble way to resolve disputes, and encourages high levels of preparation for conflict. In a militaristic society, generals and admirals are celebrated public figures, and spending on arms is seen as essential rather than optional. In pre-war Europe, militarism appears in the popularity of uniforms and parades, in school textbooks that praise past victories, and in the way governments listen closely to their general staffs when making decisions. The phrase alliance system refers to the network of treaties and agreements through which states promise to support each other, especially in the event of war. Alliances are not new in European history, but after the unification of Germany in the 1870s, they become more formal and more permanent. Political leaders hope that alliances will deter enemies by making clear that any aggression will meet a united response. At the same time, alliances can create chains of obligation. A local conflict that might have been limited can pull in allies on both sides and grow into something much larger. Closely related to this is the idea of a balance of power. The balance of power is the notion that peace in Europe is best preserved when no single state, or coalition of states, is strong enough to dominate all the others. If one power becomes too strong, the others are expected to cooperate to restore balance. 19th century European diplomacy often operates on this principle. It is an attempt to keep order in an international system where there is no higher authority above states. Within this alliance system, it is useful to distinguish formal alliances from looser understandings. A formal alliance is a signed treaty that spells out, sometimes in very specific language, under what conditions one state will support another with military force. The Triple Alliance, which we will discuss later, is an example of this. An entente, by contrast, literally means an understanding. It is usually a diplomatic agreement that settles outstanding disputes and commit states to consult and cooperate, without always promising automatic military support. The Triple Entente, as it develops before 1914, grows out of such understandings. Two more technical terms are important for the story of July 1914 and for the culture of war planning more generally. Mobilization is the process by which a state moves from peacetime conditions to readiness for war. It involves calling up reservists, assigning officers, preparing transport, and moving troops toward potential fronts. In the age of large conscript armies and complex rail networks, mobilization is a massive logistical operation that follows detailed timetables. An ultimatum is a final diplomatic demand presented to another state, usually with a clear time limit and with the warning that failure to accept the terms will bring serious consequences, often war. In tense situations, ultimatums and mobilization orders are highly escalatory steps. With these concepts in place, we can turn to the reshaping of the European state system in the late 19th century. Before the 1860s, the political map of Europe looks quite different from the one that exists on the eve of World War I. Large, multi-ethnic empires, such as the Habsburg monarchy, which later becomes known as Austria-Hungary, the Russian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire, dominate much of Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe. In contrast, the area that will later be called Germany is divided into many kingdoms and principalities, and the Italian peninsula is split among several states and foreign rulers. In this older order, legitimacy rests heavily on dynasties. Ruling families like the Habsburgs, the Romanovs, and the Ottoman Sultans claim authority because of lineage and tradition, not because they lead nation-states that coincide neatly with a single people. This does not mean that national feelings do not exist.
They do, but they are often suppressed or contained within larger imperial structures. The idea of a Europe composed primarily of self-conscious nations, each with its own state, is still emerging. German unification changes this landscape dramatically. In the 1860s and early 1870s, the Kingdom of Prussia, the largest and most powerful of the German states, leads a series of conflicts and diplomatic maneuvers that bring most other German territories under its leadership. The decisive moment comes in the Franco-Prussian War, which begins in 1870. Prussia and its German allies defeat France relatively quickly. In January 1871, in the aftermath of this victory, the German Empire is proclaimed in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, a symbolic site deep in French territory. The new German Empire is a formidable power. It has a large and growing population, advanced industry, and a well-organized army. Its central position in Europe gives it strategic advantages, but also potential vulnerabilities, since it now shares borders with many other major powers, including France and Russia. German unification, therefore, does more than simply tidy up the map. It creates a new, powerful actor in the heart of Europe and unsettles the previous balance of power. At the same time, Italy also moves toward unification. Through a mixture of wars, popular uprisings, and diplomacy, most of the Italian peninsula is brought together under the House of Savoy, creating the Kingdom of Italy by the 1870s. In comparison with Germany, Italy is less industrialized and less powerful militarily, but its creation still matters. It signals that nationalist movements can successfully challenge old dynastic arrangements, and it contributes to the general trend toward a Europe of nation-states. These developments throw into sharp contrast the situation of the multi-ethnic empires. Austria-Hungary is a patchwork of Germans, Hungarians, Czechs, Slovaks, Poles, Ukrainians, Croats, Serbs, Romanians, Italians, and other groups, many with their own languages and nationalist aspirations. The Compromise of 1867, which creates the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary, gives Hungarians significant autonomy, but leaves many other nationalities dissatisfied. The Russian Empire, stretching from Poland to the Pacific, contains Poles, Finns, Ukrainians, Baltic peoples, Caucasian groups, Central Asians, and many more. The Ottoman Empire still rules parts of southeastern Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa, but it too faces strong nationalist movements among Greeks, Serbs, Bulgarians, Armenians, Arabs, and others. As nationalism grows stronger, these empires face difficult questions. Can they transform themselves into more inclusive political communities that accommodate diversity, or will they be forced to grant independence to some peoples while repressing others? Their struggles with these questions will be especially acute in regions like the Balkans, which we will discuss in more detail later. For now, it is important to recognize that the rise of unified nation-states, such as Germany and Italy, increases the contrast between relatively homogeneous national communities and complex imperial structures. The Franco-Prussian War not only creates the German Empire, it also leaves a deep and lasting mark on French politics and Franco-German relations. As part of the peace settlement, the new Germany annexes the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, rich in industry and strategically located along the border. For many French people, this loss is experienced as a profound humiliation. A desire for revenge, often captured in the single French word revanche, becomes a recurring theme in French political life. In the decades after 1871, recovering Alsace-Lorraine becomes a central goal for many French nationalists. Schoolchildren learn about the lost provinces, veterans groups keep the memory of defeat alive, and political leaders invoke the issue when appealing to patriotic feeling. Germany, on the other hand, sees its control of Alsace-Lorraine as both a prize and a security necessity. The new state wants recognition as a great power and fears that France will one day seek to reverse the outcome of 1870. This shared border, charged with emotion and symbolism, becomes one of the fixed points of tension in Europe. These tensions shape the diplomacy of Otto von Bismarck, the first chancellor of the German Empire.
Bismarck is keenly aware that a powerful new Germany in Central Europe may look threatening to its neighbors. He is also aware that, if France can find strong allies, Germany could face the nightmare of a war on two fronts, against France in the west and Russia in the east. His main goal is therefore to preserve peace in Europe while consolidating Germany's gains and preventing France from escaping diplomatic isolation. To achieve this, Bismarck constructs a complex set of alliances and understandings with other major powers. He seeks close ties with Austria-Hungary,
both because of traditional links and because he believes that a friendly Habsburg Empire will help stabilize Central and Eastern Europe. He also works to maintain good relations with Russia, another large land power bordering Germany. At various moments, he brings the emperors of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia into common agreements, trying to keep disputes in regions like the Balkans under control. Bismarck's system rests on several principles. First, Germany should avoid direct colonial confrontations with Britain, whose navy dominates the seas. Second, no hostile coalition should be allowed to form that could threaten Germany's security. Third, European peace should be maintained through a flexible balance of power in which Germany acts as a kind of honest broker in disputes that do not touch its vital interests. Under his guidance, the alliance system is meant to be stable yet adaptable, a way to freeze the existing order and keep France diplomatically marginalized. However, this system depends heavily on Bismarck's personal skills and judgments. When he is dismissed from office in 1890, the German leadership takes a different direction. The new course includes a more assertive foreign policy and an interest in building a global navy and empire. Some of Bismarck's carefully crafted agreements, especially with Russia, are allowed to lapse. As a result, over the following decades, the flexible web of understandings he created gradually hardens into two more clearly defined and rival blocs. The next step is to examine the formation of these two opposing groups, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente. The Triple Alliance is a formal agreement that binds Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy together. It is defensive in its wording, promising that the partners will assist each other if they are attacked by certain other powers. For Germany, it provides reassurance that Austria-Hungary will stand by it, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. For Austria-Hungary, it offers the backing of a strong industrial power. Italy, a newer and somewhat insecure state, gains two major allies, though its commitments and loyalties will later prove complicated. On the other side, a looser association grows up that becomes known as the Triple Entente. It does not begin as a single treaty. It starts with a military alliance between France and Russia in the 1890s. Both countries feel threatened by Germany. France wants protection against a renewed German attack in the West, and Russia is concerned about German influence in Central and Eastern Europe. Their alliance ends France's post-1871 isolation and gives Russia a powerful partner. Britain, for much of the 19th century, prefers a policy often described as splendid isolation, avoiding binding commitments on the continent while focusing on its global empire. However, by the early 20th century, British leaders are increasingly worried about challenges to naval supremacy and about the costs of remaining isolated. A settlement with France, known as the Entente Cordiale, is reached in 1904, easing imperial rivalries, especially in Africa. A similar agreement with Russia follows in 1907, dealing with their competing interests in Asia. These understandings are not formal military alliances in the same sense as the Triple Alliance. They do not initially commit Britain to automatically enter a war on France's or Russia's side. However, they mark a major shift in European diplomacy. In practice, over the decade before 1914, joint military conversations, common planning, and shared perceptions of threat increasingly draw France, Russia, and Britain together. By the eve of the war, Europe is divided into two main camps, and many leaders assume that any serious conflict will pit these blocs against one another. This emerging division is not caused by imperialism alone, but imperial competition plays an important role.
To see this, we have to consider the global dimension of European rivalry. In the late 19th century, European powers greatly expand their direct control over territories in Africa and Asia. Historians often refer to this as the scramble for Africa. Within a few decades, much of the African continent that had previously been governed by local states and societies comes under European colonial rule. Britain establishes control over vast regions from Egypt to South Africa. France builds a large empire in West and Central Africa. Belgium, under the guise of a personal project of its king, seizes the Congo. Other powers, including Portugal, Italy, and Germany, also gain territories. In Asia, imperial expansion continues as well. Britain dominates the Indian subcontinent and exerts influence in the Persian Gulf and parts of China. France rules Indochina.
Russia expands southward into Central Asia and eastward toward the Pacific. These empires are not only symbols of prestige, they provide raw materials, markets for industrial goods, and strategic naval bases. Competition over them sometimes sparks diplomatic crises that test alliances and ententes. Germany's position in this imperial race is distinctive. Because it unifies relatively late, in 1871, it has no large overseas empire when it becomes a major power. In the following decades, German leaders and interest groups push for what they call a place in the sun. Germany acquires colonies in Africa and the Pacific, but by this time, most of the easily accessible territories are already claimed. As a result, German imperial ambitions bring Berlin into conflict with older colonial powers, especially France and Britain. These colonial disputes are not purely local matters. Whenever there is a confrontation between Germany and France over a region such as Morocco, or between Britain and Russia over some frontier in Asia, leaders in European capitals watch closely. They ask whether allies will stand firm or waver, and whether understandings will hold or break. Each crisis becomes a kind of rehearsal for larger conflict, deepening mistrust, or, in some cases, forcing new accommodations. Part 2 of this course will examine some of these specific crises in detail. For now, it is enough to note that imperialism extends European rivalries across the globe and intertwines colonial questions with the balance of power at home. Alongside imperial competition, a powerful and visible arms race develops. On land, major continental powers such as Germany, France, and Russia rely on conscription, the system by which most young men are required to serve in the army for a period and then spend years in the reserves. As international tensions rise, these states increase the length of service, enlarge their standing forces, and invest in modern equipment. Railway networks are expanded, and detailed plans are drawn up to move millions of men quickly in the event of war. The size of peacetime armies and the speed with which they can be mobilized become central measures of national strength. At sea, the most famous arms race is between Britain and Germany. For centuries, the Royal Navy has been a cornerstone of British security and imperial power. British policymakers believe that their island nation must maintain a fleet at least as strong as any potential combination of rival navies. When Germany decides to build a major battle fleet, Britain sees this as a direct challenge. The competition becomes even more intense after 1906, when Britain launches the battleship Dreadnought, a technologically advanced ship with heavy guns of a single large caliber and powerful engines. Its design makes previous battleships seem obsolete and sets a new standard for naval power. Other nations, including Germany, feel compelled to respond by building their own Dreadnought-type vessels. In the years that follow, British and German shipyards race to produce more and better battleships, and public opinion follows each new launch as a matter of national prestige. Although historians debate whether this naval race by itself makes war more likely, it certainly contributes to distrust between Britain and Germany, and helps push Britain toward closer ties with France and Russia. These material preparations are closely linked to militarism as a cultural force. In pre-war Europe, military virtues such as discipline, obedience, and courage are widely praised. Officers in smart uniforms are prominent in public ceremonies.
War is often portrayed in school textbooks, newspapers, and novels in romantic terms, with emphasis on heroism and sacrifice rather than on industrialized slaughter. While there are also strong peace movements and critical voices, the overall climate in many countries treats the armed forces as central to national identity. Within governments, militarism is reflected in the increasing influence of general staffs. A general staff is a permanent group of professional officers whose task is to plan for war in great detail during peacetime. In Germany, in France, in Russia, and elsewhere, these staffs prepare elaborate plans that specify how many trains will carry which units to which railway junctions on which days after mobilization. They analyze possible enemy moves and develop complex timetables. Over time, war planning comes to be seen as a kind of technical science. This technical view of war has important consequences. If mobilization and deployment depend on rigid schedules, then political leaders may feel that they cannot afford to wait or improvise during a crisis.
delays or partial measures risk disrupting the entire plan. In such a system, once mobilization begins, it can be very hard to stop. Moreover, many military planners believe that offense has the advantage, at least in the opening stages of a conflict. This belief encourages doctrines that emphasize rapid attack and decisive battles, which can create pressure to strike first if war seems likely. At the same time, domestic politics inside each state are becoming more complicated. Over the 19th century, many European countries gradually extend political rights. By the early 20th century, mass male suffrage, the right of adult men to vote, exists in places like Germany, France, and Italy. Parliaments gain greater influence. New political parties, especially socialist and labor parties, emerge to represent the interests of workers and the lower middle classes. These parties often criticize militarism and imperialism, and they sometimes emphasize international working class solidarity rather than nationalist rivalry. For ruling elites, these developments can be both threatening and energizing. Landed aristocracies, established churches, and business leaders worry about strikes, social unrest, and demands for redistribution. Some fear that domestic divisions might weaken their countries in a dangerous world. In this context, foreign policy can be used as a tool to create unity. A successful colonial adventure, a strong stand in a diplomatic crisis, or a lavish naval program can shift public debate from class conflict to national pride. This does not mean that leaders consciously start wars simply to distract their populations. However, it does mean that militaristic and nationalist rhetoric can be politically useful. Newspapers owned by conservative interests may play up external threats. Generals and admirals may argue that increased spending is necessary to protect the nation. In some cases, governments that are weak or divided internally may be tempted to take a tough line abroad to shore up legitimacy at home. Domestic and foreign policy become intertwined in ways that complicate any simple story about the causes of war. Within this broader picture, nationalism continues to play a double role. In relatively cohesive nation-states such as France and Germany, nationalist feeling can be harnessed by governments to support rearmament and firm diplomatic stances. In multi-ethnic empires, nationalism is often a disruptive force, as various groups seek more autonomy or independence. Nowhere is this more visible than in the Balkans, the region of southeastern Europe that becomes the most volatile fault line before 1914. The Balkans are shaped by the long decline of the Ottoman Empire in Europe. Over the 19th century, several Christian populations in the Balkans win independence or autonomy from Ottoman rule. Greece becomes an independent state in the 1820s. Serbia, Romania, and Bulgaria also gain recognition as separate principalities or kingdoms at different times. Each of these new or expanding states has its own national story and ambitions, often including the desire to incorporate neighboring territories that contain members of its ethnic group. Serbian nationalism is particularly important for the background to World War I. Modern Serbia sees itself not only as a small kingdom, but also as the core of a larger South Slavic nation that includes Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, and others living in neighboring lands.
Many of these South Slavs live not under Ottoman rule, but inside Austria-Hungary, in provinces such as Bosnia and in parts of Croatia and Slovenia. Serbian nationalists therefore often look across the border and dream of uniting these populations into a greater Serbia or a broader South Slavic state. Russia takes a special interest in Serbia and in the Balkans more generally. Russian leaders present their country as the protector of Orthodox Christians and Slavic peoples in southeastern Europe. They seek influence in the region and, strategically, hope for better access to warm water seas through control, or friendly control, of the straits connecting the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. Supporting Serbia, whether diplomatically or in more concrete ways, fits both Russia's ideological self-image and its geopolitical aims. For Austria-Hungary, these developments are deeply worrying. The Habsburg Empire contains many Slavic subjects whose loyalties cannot be taken for granted. If Serbian nationalism succeeds in detaching South Slavic lands from Habsburg rule, it could encourage similar movements among other nationalities. From Vienna's point of view, a strong, assertive Serbia backed by Russia is not just a small neighbor, but a potential mortal threat to the internal cohesion of the empire.
As a result, many Austro-Hungarian officials and military leaders come to see the suppression of Serbian influence as a matter of survival. This combination of rising Serbian nationalism, Russian support, and Austro-Hungarian fear turns the Balkans into a zone of recurring crisis. Conflicts over borders, over the status of provinces, and over the treatment of ethnic minorities repeatedly draw in outside powers. While some of these crises are managed or contained, each leaves behind resentments and lessons. Military plans are revised, alliances are tested, and public opinion is inflamed. The sense grows that the next confrontation in the region might not be so easily controlled. All of these threads come together by the eve of 1914. Europe is a continent of powerful, modern nation-states and fragile, anxious empires. The unification of Germany and Italy has both inspired and destabilized nationalist movements elsewhere. The memory of the Franco-Prussian War and the issue of Alsace-Lorraine continue to poison relations between France and Germany. The alliance system, originally intended to preserve peace by deterring aggression, has crystallized into two rival blocs, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente, whose members increasingly expect to stand together in a crisis. Imperial competition has spread European rivalries around the globe, while arms races on land and sea have created huge conscript armies and fleets of modern battleships. Militarism as a set of cultural values and institutions has made war planning a central activity of states and has elevated generals and admirals to influential positions in government. Domestic politics have grown more democratic in some respects, but also more contentious, making foreign policy a tempting arena for displays of unity and strength. In the Balkans, the decline of Ottoman authority, the ambitions of small nationalist states like Serbia, the protective stance of Russia, and the fears of Austria-Hungary have created a tinderbox. A crisis there is no longer a local matter. It is entangled with great power interests, alliance obligations, and deeply held national myths. An assassination in a Balkan city, followed by ultimatums and mobilization orders, can therefore trigger a chain reaction. When that chain reaction finally occurs in the summer of 1914, it turns a continent that has known long stretches of relative peace into a theater of mass industrial warfare and civilian suffering on an unprecedented scale. The war that follows claims more than 16 million lives and reshapes borders, societies, and political systems. Understanding why it happens requires keeping all of these long-term structural factors in view, while also paying close attention to the decisions taken during the specific crises that precede the outbreak. Part 2 will move from this broad background to those crises themselves. It will trace how confrontations over imperial questions and Balkan disputes accustom leaders to brinkmanship, and then follow, step by step, how the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo leads, through ultimatums, mobilizations, and alliance commitments, to a general war.
With the structural context in mind, it becomes easier to see why those decisions are made and why they have such catastrophic consequences. By this point, the larger shape of pre-war Europe is clear. Powerful nation-states such as Germany, France, and Britain confront anxious multi-ethnic empires such as Austria-Hungary, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire. Nationalism pulls peoples toward self-rule, imperialism pushes the great powers into rivalry across the globe, and militarism gives generals, admirals, and war plans an outsized role in politics. Alliances harden into two opposed groups, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente, and the Balkans stand out as a particularly dangerous zone where imperial decline and nationalist ambition directly collide. What remains less clear is how this tense but still peaceful order turns into a shooting war that engulfs most of Europe. The answer lies in a series of concrete confrontations in the decade before 1914, and then in the tightly compressed weeks after an assassination in Sarajevo. The structural factors just described shape how leaders see these crises, but it is their choices within each confrontation that gradually narrow the path away from war. The years from roughly 1905 to 1914 are often described as a decade of crises. Again and again, disputes flare up that could, in principle, bring the alliance blocs into direct conflict. Each time, war is avoided, usually at the last moment or through hurried conferences and back-channel negotiations.
Yet each time, something changes. Trust erodes, resentments deepen, and leaders grow accustomed to brinkmanship. The pattern of crisis and last-minute compromise teaches them lessons, some of which turn out to be dangerously misleading by the summer of 1914. The first of these major confrontations is the First Moroccan Crisis. It begins in 1905 and centers on the North African Kingdom of Morocco. France has long had economic and political interests there, and the Entente Cordiale of 1904 between Britain and France quietly recognizes that France will be the dominant outside power in Morocco, while Britain focuses on neighboring regions. Germany sees this as both a threat and an opportunity. Berlin worries that the Anglo-French understanding is the beginning of an anti-German coalition. At the same time, German leaders believe they can test or weaken this new friendship by challenging France in a region that is not directly vital to Germany. In March 1905, the German emperor visits the Moroccan port of Tangier and publicly proclaims support for the independence of the Sultan of Morocco. The move is a direct challenge to French influence and a test of the strength of the Anglo-French understanding. The crisis escalates quickly. Germany demands an international conference to decide Morocco's future, hoping to isolate France diplomatically and to show that the Entente is fragile. France, feeling its prestige and colonial ambitions questioned, initially resists, but eventually agrees to a conference in order to avoid war. The great powers meet in the Spanish city of Algeciras in early 1906. At the Algeciras conference, German expectations are disappointed. Instead of standing aside, Britain supports France. Apart from Austria-Hungary, Germany finds itself largely alone. The final agreement gives France and Spain important roles in policing Morocco, while affirming the formal independence of the Sultan. In practice, French influence is strengthened rather than weakened. For Germany, this outcome feels like a diplomatic defeat and a sign of encirclement. Many in German public life resent what they see as a coalition of powers ganging up against them. For France and Britain, the crisis has the opposite effect. The experience of standing together and of facing down German pressure deepens trust. British leaders become more willing to consider military cooperation with France in any future conflict. The Entente Cordiale, originally a limited colonial understanding, begins to acquire a more strategic, anti-German character. The First Moroccan Crisis, then, does not produce war, but it changes the mental map of Europe's leaders. Germany sees that it cannot easily separate Britain from France. France realizes that it is no longer isolated as it was after the Franco-Prussian War. Britain starts to view Germany less as a possible partner and more as the main rival to be contained.
Crisis management, in this case a conference and eventual compromise, avoids disaster but also fixes new lines of tension. A few years later, attention shifts from North Africa back to the Balkans, where the Bosnian annexation crisis of 1908 again raises the risk of wider war. To understand this crisis, it helps to recall the uneven decline of the Ottoman Empire in southeastern Europe. Since the late 19th century, Austria-Hungary has administered the provinces of Bosnia and Herzegovina, although they still formally belong to the Ottoman Empire. These provinces contain a mixed population, including many Orthodox Christian Serbs who share language and religion with the neighboring Kingdom of Serbia. In October 1908, Austria-Hungary decides unilaterally to annex Bosnia and Herzegovina, turning them into full Habsburg territory. From Vienna's point of view, this move brings legal status into line with reality and is meant to lock down a region where Serbian and other nationalist influences are growing. However, for Serbia, the annexation is a deep provocation. Many Serbian nationalists see Bosnia, with its large Serb population, as part of their imagined future state. Austria-Hungary's action seems to slam the door on that vision. Serbia protests loudly and mobilizes public opinion against the Habsburg Empire. Russia, which has recently suffered defeat in the Russo-Japanese War and internal unrest in the Revolution of 1905, also objects. Russian leaders present themselves as protectors of Slavic and Orthodox populations in the Balkans, and many in Russia view Austria-Hungary's move as an insult and a strategic setback. The crisis intensifies when Germany steps in firmly on the side of Austria-Hungary.
Berlin signals to St. Petersburg that if Russia insists on a European conference or backs Serbia too strongly, Germany will support Austria-Hungary, even at the risk of war. In early 1909, facing military and financial weakness, Russia backs down. The Russian government effectively advises Serbia to accept the annexation and to avoid further escalation. This retreat has important consequences. In Russia, the sense of humiliation is acute. Influential figures in the government and the army conclude that Russia must never again allow itself to be forced into retreat by German threats. They begin an effort to rebuild military strength and to make future support for Serbia more concrete. In Austria-Hungary, success in pushing through the annexation, with German backing, encourages those who believe that a firm line against Serbia and Slavic nationalism will work. For Serbia, the outcome feeds a deepening hostility toward Austria-Hungary. Many Serbs, including some within the army and in secret nationalist groups, draw the lesson that only radical action will break Habsburg control over South Slavic lands. Although war is avoided, the Bosnian annexation crisis leaves behind anger and a hardening of positions, especially in St. Petersburg and Belgrade. A third major confrontation comes in 1911 with the Second Moroccan Crisis, often called the Agadir Crisis. Once again, the scene is North Africa, but the underlying issue is the broader balance of power in Europe. By this time, France has pushed further into Morocco, and a rebellion against the Sultan gives Paris a pretext to send troops to the interior city of Fez to protect European citizens and interests. Germany reacts by sending a small warship, the gunboat Panther, to the Moroccan Atlantic port of Agadir. Officially, the move is justified as a protection mission for German nationals. In reality, European observers understand that it is an attempt to pressure France and to obtain colonial concessions elsewhere, perhaps in the French Congo, in exchange for German recognition of French dominance in Morocco. The sudden arrival of the Panther, a symbol of German naval power, alarms not only France, but also Britain. In London, officials worry less about Morocco itself and more about the possibility that Germany could establish a naval base on the Atlantic coast, threatening sea lanes. British leaders also fear that a pattern is emerging in which Germany repeatedly tests the resolve of the Entente. During the crisis, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, David Lloyd George, delivers a public speech in July 1911, warning that Britain cannot remain neutral if its vital interests and those of its friends are endangered. After tense negotiations, the crisis again ends with compromise rather than war.
France secures international acceptance of its protectorate over Morocco. Germany receives some territory in Central Africa as compensation. Yet the result is widely perceived as another German retreat. In Berlin, nationalists and many in public opinion are angered that the government seems to have backed down under pressure from France and Britain. In London and Paris, the presence of the gunboat Panther and the memory of German pressure deepen suspicion and accelerate military and naval cooperation. By now, a pattern is clearly visible. Germany repeatedly tries to use controlled risk to reshape the diplomatic landscape in its favor, especially by testing the cohesion of the Entente. France and Britain, instead of splitting, respond by drawing closer together. Crises end without general war, but they leave scars and strengthen blocs, making future confrontation more dangerous. The next shocks come in the Balkans, with the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913. These wars do not directly involve all the great powers, but their outcomes fundamentally alter the regional balance and intensify great power anxieties, especially in Vienna and St. Petersburg. In the First Balkan War, which begins in the autumn of 1912, a coalition known as the Balkan League attacks the Ottoman Empire. This league includes Serbia, Bulgaria, Greece, and Montenegro. Encouraged by the perception that the Ottoman Empire is weak and that the great powers are distracted or divided, these states seek to seize remaining Ottoman territories in Europe. Their armies advance rapidly, and within a few months, the Ottomans lose most of their European lands, retaining little more than a small area around Constantinople. Serbia is one of the main winners of the First Balkan War. The Serbian army captures significant new territories to the south and west, including regions with mixed populations that include many Slavs. This expansion fits well with Serbian nationalist dreams of gathering South Slavs into a larger political unit under Belgrade's leadership. In Serbia, prestige and confidence rise sharply. The army is proud of its performance, and the public is emboldened by apparent success. Austria-Hungary views this Serbian growth with deep alarm. From Vienna's perspective, every gain by Serbia is a potential loss for the Habsburg Empire, because it strengthens a rival nationalist pole that appeals to Slavic subjects inside Habsburg borders. Austria-Hungary is especially determined to prevent Serbia from gaining direct access to the Adriatic Sea, which would enable it to become a more significant economic and naval power. With the support of other great powers, a new state, Albania, is created along the coast, largely blocking Serbia's route to the sea. This diplomatic maneuver frustrates Serbia and adds another layer of resentment toward Vienna. The Second Balkan War breaks out in 1913, when disagreements over the division of the conquered territories lead Bulgaria to attack its former allies, primarily Serbia and Greece. The conflict is short, and Bulgaria is quickly defeated. Serbia gains even more land, further expanding in the south. By the end of 1913, Serbia is significantly larger, more confident, and more assertive than it was a few years earlier. In Russia, the Balkan Wars reinforce the image of Serbia as a courageous Slavic ally, standing up to both the Ottoman Empire and, indirectly, Austria-Hungary. Russian public opinion and many officials feel a strong sympathy for Serbian ambitions and a corresponding hostility toward Habsburg efforts to restrict them. In Austria-Hungary, the same events have the opposite effect. The prospect of a growing, Russian-backed Serbia on its southern border seems increasingly intolerable. Several senior military and political leaders in Vienna begin to argue that a decisive confrontation with Serbia is necessary, sooner rather than later, while Austria-Hungary still has the strength, and while Russia is not yet fully rearmed. In all of these Balkan crises, the great powers manage, through conferences and diplomatic interventions, to prevent the local wars from expanding into a larger conflict. Yet the price of this containment is high in terms of mutual trust. Russian leaders feel that they have repeatedly had to restrain Serbia and accept outcomes that favor Austria-Hungary. They vow that the next time a Balkan crisis emerges, they will not back down so easily.
Austrian leaders, in turn, are convinced that further delay will only make Serbia stronger and more dangerous. They begin to see a clash as almost inevitable. Looking back at this decade of confrontation, a clear pattern emerges. Each crisis is resolved short of general war. Conferences are convened, compromises are hammered out, and the international system, at least on the surface, survives. But beneath that surface, bitterness accumulates. Germany feels encircled and humiliated by diplomatic defeats in Morocco. France and Britain become more tightly bound by shared experiences of standing up to Germany. Russia feels twice humbled, in the Bosnian crisis and in the management of the Balkan Wars. Austria-Hungary fears that time is against it in the struggle with Serbian nationalism. At the same time, these repeated crises have another, more subtle effect. They teach statesmen and military leaders that brinkmanship can work. Firm threats, rapid partial mobilizations, and last-minute agreements seem to be manageable tools. This encourages an optimism about crisis management, the belief that even very tense situations can be controlled if handled skillfully. When the next and final pre-war crisis comes in the summer of 1914, many decision-makers approach it with lessons drawn from these earlier confrontations, some of which turn out to be dangerously misleading. The immediate trigger of that final crisis is an assassination in Sarajevo, the capital of the Habsburg province of Bosnia and Herzegovina. On June 28, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, visits the city to observe military maneuvers and to make a public appearance with his wife, Sophie. The date is symbolically charged. For many Serbs, June 28, known as Vidovdan, is a day of national remembrance associated with medieval battles and sacrifice. A group of young Bosnian Serb nationalists, connected to underground networks that reach into neighboring Serbia, plan to kill the Archduke during his visit. Their goal is to strike at the Habsburg dynasty and to draw attention to the cause of South Slavic nationalism. Several conspirators position themselves along the Archduke's motorcade route. The first assassination attempt fails. A bomb thrown at the car explodes under a following vehicle, injuring members of the entourage, but not the Archduke. Remarkably, the visit continues. Later in the day, as Franz Ferdinand and Sophie travel through the city in an open car, their driver takes a wrong turn near a side street. There, by chance, one of the conspirators, Gavrilo Princip, finds himself unexpectedly close to his target. Princip steps forward and fires his pistol at close range, fatally wounding both the Archduke and his wife. The killings in Sarajevo shock Europe, but they do not automatically mean war. Assassinations of prominent figures are not unprecedented in this period. What makes this event different is what Austria-Hungary decides to do with it, and how the alliance system and military plans interact with those decisions. From late June to early August, a series of linked choices, taken in Vienna, Berlin, St. Petersburg, Paris, and London, turns a regional outrage into a continent-wide war. The period that follows is often called the July Crisis. To follow it clearly, it helps to keep the dates in mind. The assassination takes place on June 28th. For several days, public funerals and initial investigations unfold. Behind the scenes, leading figures in Vienna debate their response. Many in the Austro-Hungarian leadership, especially in the army, see the assassination as the perfect pretext to crush Serbia once and for all. They argue that the empire's credibility and internal stability require a strong military reaction. Austria-Hungary's leaders, however, are aware that Serbia is backed by Russia. Before acting, they want assurance of German support. This leads to a critical moment early in July. On July 5, 1914, the Austro-Hungarian ambassador in Berlin meets with the German emperor and the German chancellor to discuss Vienna's desire for a firm line against Serbia, possibly including military action. In what later becomes known as the blank check, Germany signals unqualified support. The details of the conversation are recorded in diplomatic reports. In one such account, the ambassador notes that the Kaiser assures him that Austria-Hungary can rely on Germany's full support, even if serious European complications ensue.
That reported phrase captures the essence of the message. Germany is prepared to stand by its ally even if Russia and perhaps other powers become involved. This German guarantee has profound effects in Vienna. It strengthens the hand of those who favor a hard line and encourages the belief that a swift, punitive action against Serbia can be carried out without facing the rest of Europe alone. At the same time, German leaders in Berlin convince themselves that a firm Austrian response, backed by Germany, can perhaps be kept local, or at least that Russia can be deterred from intervening if confronted with a solid Austro-German front. After receiving the blank check, the Austro-Hungarian government takes several days to prepare a diplomatic note to Serbia. They want to ensure that their demands are so severe that Serbia will almost certainly reject them, providing a justification for war that looks defensible to other powers. They also deliver the note at a time when the Russian and French leadership are partly out of position, while the French president and foreign minister are on a visit to Russia, and communication among capitals is more cumbersome. On July 23, 1914, Austria-Hungary delivers its ultimatum to Serbia. The note lists 10 main demands, framed as measures to suppress anti-Habsburg agitation. Some of these demands concern the suppression of hostile publications and societies. Others call for the dismissal of officials and officers whom Austria-Hungary accuses of involvement in subversive activities. One of the most extreme demands insists that Serbia must accept the participation of Austro-Hungarian officials in investigations and measures on Serbian soil. The ultimatum states that Serbia must permit the cooperation in Serbia of organs of the Austro-Hungarian government in suppressing movements directed against the monarchy. For a sovereign state, this amounts to allowing foreign agents to operate within its legal system and security apparatus. The note also imposes a very short deadline. Serbia has 48 hours to respond. The tone and content of this ultimatum alarm other capitals. Even in Berlin, some officials privately recognize that certain demands strike at the core of Serbian sovereignty. In St. Petersburg and Paris, the list is seen as deliberately provocative, designed more to be rejected than accepted. However, the very harshness of the ultimatum also creates pressure on Serbia to appear as conciliatory as possible in order to win sympathy from other powers. Serbia's government faces an almost impossible choice.
full acceptance of all the demands, especially those involving foreign participation in Serbian internal affairs, would mean a serious loss of independence and prestige. Rejection risks a devastating war with a much stronger neighbor. Under the watchful eyes of foreign diplomats, Serbian leaders draft a long and carefully worded reply. On July 25th, Serbia delivers its response. In this note, the Serbian government accepts most of Austria-Hungary's demands or offers to submit them to international arbitration. It promises to suppress hostile propaganda, to prosecute those involved in the assassination plot, and to share the results of its investigations. However, on key points involving the presence of Austro-Hungarian officials on Serbian soil, the reply draws a line. One passage declares that Serbia cannot admit measures that would violate the Constitution and the law of criminal procedure, or that would be incompatible with the dignity and independence of the state. The tone of the Serbian reply is notably conciliatory. Many neutral observers at the time, and many historians since, judge that Serbia goes remarkably far in yielding to Habsburg demands. In St. Petersburg and Paris, the Serbian response is seen as a serious attempt to avoid war. In Vienna, however, officials quickly judge the reply to be inadequate. They seize on the reservations about foreign investigators as proof that Serbia has not truly submitted. On the very day Serbia delivers its reply, Austria-Hungary breaks off diplomatic relations. The machinery of escalation, which has already been set in motion, now accelerates. Here, a key concept from earlier becomes central again: mobilization. Mobilization is the process by which a state shifts from peacetime conditions to readiness for war.
It involves calling up reservists, requisitioning horses and vehicles, assigning officers to their wartime commands, and organizing the transport of troops and supplies, often by rail, to positions near potential frontiers. In the early 20th century, this process is governed by detailed timetables drawn up in advance by general staffs. These timetables are closely linked to specific war plans. For Germany, the most important is what later becomes known as the Schlieffen Plan, named after a former chief of the general staff. This plan assumes that in a war against both France and Russia, Germany must strike quickly in the west, advancing through neutral Belgium to encircle and defeat French forces, while holding off Russia in the east until victory in France frees up troops. The apparent success of such a plan seems to depend on rapid and precise execution. Once mobilization begins, trains must run on schedule to carry units to assigned sectors. In this system, partial mobilization or significant delay is seen as dangerous, even fatal. Because all major powers now have such elaborate war plans tied to mobilization schedules, the act of mobilizing comes to be almost equivalent to choosing war. It is not yet actual fighting, but it is a step that is hard to reverse. Political leaders understand that once they order general mobilization, their options narrow sharply. On July 28, 1914, Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia. Artillery shells begin to fall on Belgrade, the Serbian capital. This is still, in theory, a limited war between one great power and a small Balkan state. But Russia now faces a stark decision. To allow Austria-Hungary to crush Serbia would mean accepting a major setback for Russian influence and prestige in the Balkans, a region where, as earlier crises have shown, Russia has repeatedly compromised and backed down. In response, Russian leaders first consider and then order a partial mobilization. On July 29th, they authorize mobilization in military districts facing Austria-Hungary, but not those facing Germany. The idea is to signal seriousness to Vienna while trying not to provoke Berlin directly. However, Russian generals quickly argue that partial mobilization is technically unworkable and militarily disadvantageous. The complex railway and deployment plans, they claim, are designed for general mobilization, not for selective measures. Under pressure from his military advisors, Tsar Nicholas II approves general mobilization on July 30th. That same day, he and the German emperor exchange telegrams in an effort to persuade each other that their steps are defensive. In one message, Nicholas insists that it is technically impossible to stop our military preparations, emphasizing that he does not wish for war, but cannot leave Serbia without support. From Berlin's perspective, Russian general mobilization is decisive. German leaders have long regarded it as a direct threat, in part because of their own war plans and the fear of a two-front conflict.
Once they receive confirmation that Russia is mobilizing across the board, they conclude that Germany must respond if it is not to be caught unprepared. German diplomats send an ultimatum to St. Petersburg, demanding that Russia halt its mobilization. No such halt occurs. On August 1, 1914, Germany declares war on Russia. The alliance system now begins to operate in earnest. France, bound to Russia by the military alliance concluded in the 1890s, has already begun to take precautionary measures. As the crisis deepens, France orders general mobilization as well, but it avoids issuing a declaration of war first, hoping that Germany will be seen as the aggressor if fighting begins. Germany, however, acts on the assumption that war with France is inevitable and that speed is crucial. On August 2nd, German forces demand passage through neutral Belgium as part of the Schlieffen Plan's Western Offensive. The Belgian government refuses, citing its rights and obligations as a neutral state guaranteed by international treaty. On August 3rd, Germany declares war on France, accusing Paris of hostile acts and justifying its own moves as preemptive. Belgium's refusal to allow German troops to pass, and Germany's decision to proceed with invasion anyway, now draws Britain directly into the crisis. Since the 19th century, Britain has been one of the guarantors of Belgian neutrality, recognized in international agreements as a key element of the European balance of power.
In London, debates unfold within the cabinet and parliament about whether this obligation requires Britain to enter a continental war. The German government hopes that Britain will remain neutral or intervene only diplomatically. However, the violation of Belgian neutrality, combined with fears of a single dominant power controlling the Channel coast opposite Britain, shifts opinion. In a conversation on August 4th, the German Chancellor Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg reportedly complains to the British ambassador that Britain is going to war over a scrap of paper, meaning the treaty guaranteeing Belgian neutrality. According to the ambassador's later account, the very contempt implicit in that phrase only reinforces British resolve. Later on August 4th, when Germany does not accept British demands to respect Belgian neutrality and halt its advance, Britain declares war on Germany. Within a little more than 5 weeks of the shots in Sarajevo, a conflict that begins as a confrontation between Austria-Hungary and Serbia has become a general European war involving all the major powers. Throughout this rapid escalation, misperception plays a crucial role. Austrian leaders in late July expect, or at least hope, that their conflict with Serbia can remain localized, as earlier Balkan confrontations have sometimes done. They underestimate the strength of Russian commitment to Serbia after the humiliations of the Bosnian annexation crisis and the Balkan Wars. German leaders, when they issue the blank check, imagine that firm support for Austria-Hungary will deter Russia, or that any war, if it comes, can be fought under relatively favorable conditions sooner rather than later. Russian leaders, when they move from partial to general mobilization, hope that a show of force will push Austria-Hungary to limit its war with Serbia and perhaps accept mediation. They misjudge how automatic Germany's response to Russian mobilization will be, given the constraints of German war planning. French leaders, bound by alliance and guided by their own military doctrine emphasizing offensive action, believe that rapid mobilization and readiness will both deter Germany and prepare France to fight effectively if deterrence fails. There is also a widespread belief, shared in different forms on all sides, that any war that does occur will be relatively short and limited. Military planning and public rhetoric emphasize decisive battles and quick victories. Some leaders and newspapers speak in terms of soldiers being back before the leaves fall or home by Christmas. Few seriously imagine years of trench warfare and mass industrial slaughter. Comparisons are drawn, consciously or unconsciously, to the brief wars of the late 19th century, such as the Franco-Prussian War, rather than to the grimmer possibilities of modern firepower and prolonged stalemate. Finally, the very success of crisis management in previous years contributes to a fatal overconfidence. Statesmen have grown used to brinkmanship followed by compromise. They assume that, even at this late stage, some conference or last-minute deal may still pull Europe back from the brink. When ultimatums, mobilization orders, and declarations of war come in rapid succession, the window for such diplomatic improvisation closes much faster than many expect. By early August 1914, then, Europe finds itself at war, not because one single step mechanically causes the next, but because a chain of interlocking decisions, taken under intense time pressure and shaped by previous crises, narrows the range of options. Austria-Hungary chooses to use the Sarajevo assassination as the occasion for a showdown with Serbia. Germany chooses to back Austria-Hungary very firmly and to rely on war plans that make early offensive action seem both necessary and unavoidable. Russia chooses, after years of retreat, to mobilize in defense of Serbia. France chooses to stand by Russia and prepare for a continental war. Britain chooses to uphold Belgian neutrality and to prevent a single power from dominating the European mainland's western coast. Part 2 has followed how these choices unfold over a decade of confrontations and in the fateful weeks of the July crisis. Each earlier crisis stops short of war, but leaves behind new grievances and new habits of brinkmanship. The July crisis itself develops as a rapidly tightening sequence of decisions, in which mobilization timetables, alliance expectations, and misjudgments about other states' intentions all play a part.
The question that now arises is how to assess responsibility within this chain of events. To what extent are structural forces, such as nationalism, imperialism, and alliance systems to blame? And to what extent do specific leaders, doctrines, and decisions carry the weight? Part 3 turns to that analytical task. It examines how war planning and civil-military relations shape choices, and then how different historians interpret the origins of World War I. A useful place to begin is with the mechanics of pre-war planning. By the early 20th century, all the major continental powers maintain permanent general staffs. These are elite groups of professional officers whose peacetime job is to prepare for future war in meticulous detail. They do not simply draw arrows on maps. They design schedules specifying which reserve regiment boards which train at which station, on which day and at which hour after a mobilization order, and exactly where that train will disembark its passengers near the front. In a Europe crisscrossed by dense railway networks and committed to mass conscript armies, such planning seems essential. The German general staff is often seen as the most developed version of this system. Its prestige is very high, rooted in the memory of rapid victories in the wars of German unification. Staff officers devote enormous effort to building a plan that can cope with the nightmare scenario German strategists fear most, a war on two fronts, against France in the west and Russia in the east. The plan that emerges under successive chiefs of staff, later popularly known as the Schlieffen Plan, assumes that Germany must defeat France quickly before turning to face Russia. The core assumption behind this plan is that Russia, because of its size and less developed railway network, will mobilize more slowly than France. This creates, in German eyes, a short window. In that window, Germany can concentrate almost all of its forces in the west, execute a huge right-wing sweep through Belgium and northern France, encircle French armies, and force a decision within weeks. Once that is done, German forces can be shifted eastward by rail to confront Russia. The plan therefore links German security directly to rapid offensive action, and it depends absolutely on trains running to schedule and reservists appearing on time. France and Russia also develop their own elaborate plans, strongly influenced by the same belief that offense holds the advantage. In France, military doctrine before 1914 emphasizes what is known as the offensive à outrance, an approach that means attack to the utmost. French plans prioritize early offensives into Alsace-Lorraine and other contested regions based on the conviction that national morale and willpower, expressed through bold attacks, can overcome defensive fire. In Russia, planners count on sheer numbers and the ability to mobilize large forces to put pressure on both Austria-Hungary and Germany. Railway timetables are central in these plans as well. Once a general mobilization order is issued, reservists begin to leave their civilian jobs, and complex flows of trains start to move toward the frontiers. In this environment, the idea of stopping or reversing mobilization seems almost impossible to professional officers. From a technical point of view, they insist that the plan must be executed fully or not at all. This is where a use-it-or-lose-it mentality around mobilization develops. Military planners warn political leaders that if their own state does not mobilize promptly when a rival begins to do so,
it risks catastrophic defeat. Each day's delay means the enemy moves more troops into favorable positions, while one's own forces remain scattered. The logic of security pushes toward acting first, or at least not lagging behind. As a result, mobilization comes to be seen by most leaders as almost identical with choosing war. In formal terms, a mobilization order is distinct from a declaration of war, but in practice, it is very difficult to mobilize fully and then stand down without fighting. No government wants to be caught with its forces half prepared if war breaks out. This helps explain why, in July 1914, Russian and German leaders both treat the other side's general mobilization as an immediate and existential danger. The rigidity of war plans matters not just technically, but politically. When crisis erupts, general staffs present their governments with stark options. They often insist that partial or delayed mobilization is militarily senseless.
That claim constrains political choice. Civilian leaders who might wish to explore diplomatic alternatives or to calibrate their response find themselves told that the railways, more than the cabinets, now set the tempo. Understanding how much that matters requires looking more closely at the relationship between civilian leaders and military staffs in several key states, especially Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. In theory, in all three, the monarch and the civilian government hold supreme authority. In practice, the degree to which they can question, overrule, or modify military plans varies significantly. In Germany, the Constitution of the German Empire places the army formally under the direct command of the Kaiser, the Emperor. The Imperial Chancellor, who heads the civilian government, is responsible to the Kaiser rather than to an elected parliament. The General Staff enjoys considerable autonomy in military planning and in advising the monarch. Civilian politicians, even at the highest level, often feel that they lack both the expertise and the institutional leverage to challenge detailed operational plans. On the eve of war, this structure has strong consequences. When the crisis with Russia and France sharpens in late July and early August 1914, the German chief of the General Staff argues forcefully that once Russian general mobilization is confirmed, Germany must activate the full plan for a Western offensive through Belgium. Inside the military, there is little serious debate about alternative strategies, such as a more defensive posture on one front or the other. The Kaiser and the Chancellor, even if they have doubts about the political wisdom of violating Belgian neutrality and provoking Britain, find that reversing the military timetable would mean, in their eyes, courting disaster. In Austria-Hungary, the pattern is similar in some ways, but colored by the empire's internal tensions. The chief of the Austro-Hungarian General Staff is a strong advocate of a hard line against Serbia. He believes that a swift punitive war is necessary to preserve the empire's prestige and to deter further nationalist agitation. The foreign minister and some other civilian officials sometimes talk in more cautious terms, worried about Russian reaction and about the risk of involving the entire alliance system. Yet, once the decision is made to issue an ultimatum and then to declare war, military plans for operations against Serbia and potentially against Russia heavily structure what is possible. The fact that Austro-Hungarian planners have divided their war preparations between a campaign in the Balkans and a possible confrontation with Russia further complicates matters. Shifting forces between these options is difficult once mobilization begins. This creates a tendency to stick with the first course chosen, even if political circumstances change. Once again, timetables and railway lines quietly dictate strategy. In Russia, civil-military relations take a different form, but end in a similar constraint. The Tsar is formally the supreme commander of the armed forces. His ministers and generals present him with advice, but his personal authority is great, and institutions that might check or balance his decisions are weak. At the same time, the Russian General Staff insists that it cannot implement a partial mobilization only against Austria-Hungary without also setting in motion plans that sooner or later will involve Germany. When, during the July crisis, the Tsar and his ministers first authorize partial mobilization, the generals return with arguments that this is technically unworkable and militarily dangerous. They urge general mobilization instead. In the end, the Tsar yields to that professional judgment. His desire to support Serbia and to avoid another humiliation like the Bosnian annexation crisis
combines with the military insistence on all-or-nothing mobilization to produce a step that German leaders interpret as aimed directly at them. In all three cases, then, civilian leaders are constrained by pre-existing plans and by expert advice that presents them with limited options. This does not mean politicians are powerless. They choose whether to seek compromise, to issue ultimatums, to accept or reject replies, and to authorize mobilization in the first place. But once they have taken certain initial steps, the interaction of alliance commitments and rigid timetables greatly narrows the path.
This interplay between political choice and military structure lies at the heart of many historical debates about responsibility for the outbreak of war. Those debates form what historians call the historiography of the First World War's origins. Historiography is not simply the story itself, but the history of how that story is researched, interpreted, and argued over. It asks which documents are considered most important, what questions are posed, and how new evidence or perspectives reshape older views. For this topic, historiography is especially rich and contentious, in part because after the war, governments and societies have strong reasons either to defend or to challenge the Versailles Treaty's assignment of war guilt, primarily to Germany and its allies. Immediately after the war, official narratives in the victorious countries emphasize German and Austro-Hungarian aggression. They point to the blank check Germany gives Austria-Hungary in early July 1914, to the harshness of the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum to Serbia, and to the violation of Belgian neutrality as evidence that these powers deliberately choose war. German and Austro-Hungarian governments, for their part, publish collections of documents meant to show that they act defensively, responding to Russian mobilization and to encirclement by hostile alliances. For several decades, many historians accept some version of shared, or at least complex, responsibility. Germany and Austria-Hungary are often seen as more reckless, but Russia, France, and Britain are not portrayed as wholly innocent. Then, in the 1960s, a German historian, Fritz Fischer, fundamentally reshapes the discussion with a provocative and influential thesis. Fischer gains access to archival materials, particularly from German government and military records. He argues that key German leaders, both civilian and military, enter the July crisis with far more expansive aims than simple defense. In his interpretation, they perceive war as an opportunity to solve domestic political tensions inside Germany and to achieve long-standing goals for territorial and economic expansion on the European continent and beyond. A central piece of evidence in Fischer's argument is a document known as the September Program. This is a set of war aims drafted in September 1914 by the German Chancellor, after the war has already begun and German armies have invaded Belgium and northern France. The September Program outlines far-reaching plans. These include the permanent weakening of France through annexations and heavy reparations, the creation of satellite or dependent states in parts of Belgium and possibly in Eastern Europe, and the establishment of an economic bloc in Central Europe under German leadership. Fischer does not claim that the September Program by itself proves a pre-existing conspiracy to start the war. Rather, he argues that it reveals the kind of peace German elites hope to impose, and that it reflects ambitions that predate the crisis. He links these aspirations to earlier domestic debates about securing a place in the sun through colonial and continental expansion. Taken together, in his view, this evidence shows that German decision-makers bear a special, primary responsibility for turning the July crisis into a general war. According to Fischer, Germany is not simply pushed into war by alliance obligations or mobilization timetables. Instead, its leaders see war as a risky but potentially rewarding way to break out of what they perceive as encirclement, to redirect domestic discontent, and to establish German hegemony in Europe. Because of this, Fischer's thesis portrays World War I as, in significant part, a deliberately chosen expansionist venture, at least on the German side, rather than as an accident or a tragedy of miscalculation alone. This argument provokes intense debate, especially in West Germany, where confronting the country's past is politically and emotionally charged. Some historians support Fischer, finding additional evidence of aggressive planning and of continuity between the ambitions of the Kaiserreich and those of the later Nazi regime. Others challenge his conclusions, arguing that he overstates the degree of long-term planning,
that he underestimates the role of fear and insecurity in German decision-making, or that he neglects the actions and responsibilities of other powers.
In the early 21st century, another major work again reshapes the conversation, the book by Christopher Clarke, often referenced by its evocative title, The Sleepwalkers. Clarke approaches the origins of the war not from a single country perspective, but as a complex, interconnected system. He emphasizes that leaders in all the main capitals operate with limited information, under intense time pressure, and within cultural and political frameworks that shape what they perceive as honorable or necessary. Clarke's metaphor of sleepwalkers does not imply that leaders are innocent or unaware. Rather, it suggests that they are conscious but not fully awake to the consequences of their actions. They move step by step toward disaster without intending a continent-wide catastrophe, yet without exercising the imagination or restraint that might have averted it. In this view, responsibility is widely shared. There is no single villain, no master plan for world domination. Instead, there is a tragic interaction of nationalisms, alliance obligations, misperceptions, and flawed judgments. One of Clarke's contributions is to shift attention back to the Balkans. He argues that both Austro-Hungarian and Serbian leaders play crucial roles in creating a situation where local violence can escalate. On the Austro-Hungarian side, elements of the leadership are determined, even before Sarajevo, to deliver a decisive blow against Serbia, which they see as an existential threat to their multinational empire. On the Serbian side, radical nationalist networks, some with links to elements in the Serbian military and intelligence services, support terrorism as a tool for advancing their political goals. That support makes it far more likely that an assassination can spark a larger crisis. Clarke also treats Russia's role as central rather than secondary. Russian leaders, he argues, make conscious choices to issue early assurances of support to Serbia during the July crisis, and then to move quickly toward general mobilization. They do so in part to maintain credibility as the protector of Slavic and Orthodox peoples, and in part to prevent further erosion of Russia's influence in the Balkans. In this reading, Russia is not merely reacting passively to Austro-German pressure, but actively shaping the path toward war. Clarke does not deny that Germany and Austria-Hungary act aggressively. He acknowledges the significance of the blank check and of the harsh ultimatum to Serbia. But he insists that focusing responsibility exclusively or primarily on Berlin and Vienna misses the broader reality. The alliance system, crisis management habits, and domestic politics in all the major states combine in a way that makes a general war possible, and once certain decisions are made, increasingly likely. Between Fischer's emphasis on German expansionist war aims and Clarke's stress on shared responsibility and mutual misperception, other historians occupy positions across a spectrum. Some place particular weight on Austria-Hungary's determination to crush Serbia. They point out that, from Vienna's perspective, delaying a showdown only strengthens a hostile nationalist neighbor and weakens the empire's already fragile internal cohesion. These interpretations portray the Austro-Hungarian leadership as consciously willing to risk a wider war rather than accept further Balkan humiliation. Other scholars highlight Russian responsibility. They argue that Russian leaders, mindful of past retreats and of domestic unrest, decide early in the July crisis that they cannot allow Austria-Hungary to destroy Serbia. They send strong signals of support to Belgrade, and when confronted with Austro-Hungarian declarations of war, they move rapidly from partial to general mobilization. Because general mobilization is bound up with war plans against both Austria-Hungary and Germany, these choices, in this view, play a decisive part in turning a localized conflict into a European conflagration. French policy also comes under scrutiny. Some historians stress the role of French revanchism, the desire to recover Alsace-Lorraine and to weaken Germany. They note that French leaders, while not seeking war at any price, are committed to maintaining a tight alliance with Russia, even when Russian actions in the Balkans raise the danger of war with Germany. French military doctrine's strong emphasis on offensive operations likewise contributes to an atmosphere in which rapid mobilization and aggressive plans are politically favored.
British decisions are sometimes analyzed in terms of security concerns that go beyond immediate treaty obligations. Britain is bound by agreements that respect Belgian neutrality, but it is not formally tied by a written treaty to fight automatically alongside France and Russia. Historians who focus on British responsibility examine how fear of a single dominant power on the continent, especially one controlling the Channel ports opposite Britain, and anxiety over the German naval challenge shaped the choice to intervene. They also explore whether earlier, clearer British commitments might have deterred German or Austro-Hungarian moves, or whether ambiguity itself contributes to the problem. Running through all these interpretations is a deeper question. Is World War I structurally inevitable, or is it contingent, in the sense that it could have been avoided if different choices had been made at key moments? One way to approach this is to compare the July crisis of 1914 with the earlier crises of the previous decade. In Morocco and the Balkans, major powers repeatedly come to the brink of war and then step back. Conferences are convened, territorial compromises are hammered out, and antagonists often accept outcomes they dislike in order to avoid open conflict. These episodes show that even in a system marked by rival alliances, arms races, and nationalist passions, war is not the automatic result of every confrontation. Leaders sometimes choose restraint or are forced by circumstances to accept it. At the same time, each crisis leaves emotions raw and alters expectations. German leaders feel encircled and humiliated after the Moroccan confrontations. Russian leaders feel doubly shamed after the Bosnian annexation crisis and the management of the Balkan Wars. Austrian leaders feel that their empire's prestige has been eroded and that Serbia has grown dangerously strong. Lessons are drawn, often in the direction of greater resolve and a refusal to back down next time. This accumulated baggage weighs heavily on the decisions of 1914. From the standpoint of inevitability, one might argue that the combination of powerful nationalisms, rigid alliances, and highly offensive war plans creates a situation in which a trigger of some kind is bound to produce a major war sooner or later. The structural pressures are real, and the July crisis indeed shows how quickly events can spiral once those pressures are engaged. From the standpoint of contingency, however, it remains clear that at several points in July 1914, different choices are available. Austria-Hungary could have accepted Serbia's generally conciliatory reply to the ultimatum and claimed diplomatic victory. Germany could have used its influence in Vienna to press for such acceptance, rather than encouraging a rapid move to war. Russia could have delayed general mobilization or confined its military measures more clearly to Austria-Hungary, even at some cost to its prestige. France could have signaled more forcefully that it would not support Russian escalation over Serbia. Britain could have made its likely intervention in a continental war more explicit earlier in the crisis, perhaps affecting German calculations. Because none of these alternatives is taken, the war happens. But because they are, in principle, imaginable, and in some cases seriously discussed at the time, many historians conclude that the war is not structurally preordained. Structures shape and constrain, but they do not fully determine. What matters is the interaction between those structures and specific human judgments, misjudgments, hopes, and fears. Another way to probe responsibility is to look at what the major powers say they want once the war begins, and how those aims evolve. Early war aims reveal not just immediate reactions to the crisis, but deeper ambitions and insecurities that may have been present, at least in embryonic form, before shots are fired. For Austria-Hungary, the initial war aim is clear and relatively narrow: to punish and weaken Serbia so as to remove it as a threat to the empire's stability. This includes reducing Serbia's military capacity and political influence in the Balkans. However, as fighting spreads and casualties mount, some voices in Vienna begin to consider more radical solutions, including the partition or permanent occupation of Serbian territory. Russia enters the war officially to defend Serbia and to uphold its status as a great power with a protective role towards Slavic and Orthodox peoples.
Early discussions of war aims, however, also touch on long-standing Russian desires for greater control over the straits that connect the Black Sea to the Mediterranean, and for influence or control in parts of eastern Anatolia and the Balkans. For many in the Russian elite, a successful war might finally secure goals that had been frustrated in earlier conflicts.
France, from the outset, seeks not only to defend itself from German invasion, but also to reverse the defeat of 1871. Recovering Alsace-Lorraine is a central aim that enjoys broad public and political support. As the war develops, French leaders also speak of weakening Germany permanently so that it can no longer threaten European peace. The scale of this weakening, whether through territorial losses, reparations, or other means, becomes a subject of intense debate as the conflict drags on. In Britain, declared war aims initially focus on defending Belgian neutrality and resisting a German bid for hegemony on the continent. Over time, as British casualties rise and public opinion hardens, British leaders articulate broader objectives, including the dismantling of German naval power and the reshaping of colonies and spheres of influence. Discussions among the Allies turn increasingly toward how a post-war order should prevent a renewed German challenge. German war aims, as the September program illustrates, quickly expand beyond reversing immediate threats. The program envisages a Europe reordered under German dominance, with France and Belgium reduced in strength, with possible adjustments in the East, and with an economic sphere in Central and perhaps Southeastern Europe that is closely tied to Berlin. Whether all of these aims are firm before the war or crystallize in the glow of early victories, they demonstrate that at least some German leaders see the conflict as an opportunity for sweeping change, not merely as a struggle for survival. Across the board, then, initial motives and war aims grow during the conflict. What begins, in rhetoric at least, as defensive action or as the fulfillment of alliance obligations, often turns into a quest for security through dominance, territorial gain, or the reordering of international relations. This expansion of aims reinforces the view that while fears and defensive concerns are real, offensive ambitions also play a significant role in the outbreak and conduct of the war. Drawing these strands together, a balanced synthesis of the causes of World War I would acknowledge several layers. At the deepest level, long-term structural changes create a tense and competitive European environment. The rise of powerful nation-states, the persistence of fragile empires, and the spread of fervent nationalisms generate rivalries that are not easily resolved. Imperial expansion and economic competition extend these rivalries around the globe. Militarism, both as an institution and as a cultural value, elevates the prestige of armed forces and war planning, making military solutions seem natural or even necessary. On a second level, the alliance system and the experience of repeated pre-war crises normalize confrontation and brinkmanship. Alliances are meant to deter aggression, but they also create chains of obligation that can pull states into conflicts originally not their own. The Moroccan and Balkan crises teach leaders that firm stands and last-minute compromises can coexist. They also leave behind grievances and a determination in several capitals not to back down again. On a third level, the mechanics of war planning and mobilization sharply constrain political choice once a crisis begins. Detailed railway timetables and offensive doctrines limit the ability of civilian leaders to calibrate or reverse military measures. Mobilization becomes a point of no easy return, and each side views the other's mobilization as an immediate act of aggression, even when officially framed as defensive. Finally, at the most specific level, the decisions made during the July crisis of 1914 close off remaining exits from confrontation. Austria-Hungary chooses to interpret the Sarajevo assassination as the moment for a decisive blow against Serbia. Germany chooses to back Austria-Hungary unconditionally and to put its trust in offensive war plans that require rapid action. Russia chooses to stand by Serbia even at the risk of triggering its war plans against Germany. France chooses to support its Russian ally and does not use its influence to restrain Russian escalation. Britain chooses to uphold Belgian neutrality and the continental balance of power, eventually entering the war rather than accepting German dominance in Western Europe. World War I, then, results not from a single cause but from the combination of deep structures, recurring patterns of crisis, institutional rigidities, and specific failures of judgment in the summer of 1914. It is neither a simple accident nor an entirely premeditated project by one state alone. It is, in a strong sense, a tragedy of a whole international system that proves unable to manage its own tensions without catastrophe. For those who wish to explore these issues further, a few works stand out as especially valuable.
Fritz Fischer's study of German war aims argues that German leaders entered the July crisis with expansive ambitions and uses documents such as the September program to show how they envision a German-dominated Europe. Reading Fischer gives a clear sense of the case for assigning primary responsibility to Germany and of the archival evidence behind that claim. Christopher Clark's The Sleepwalkers offers a contrasting, detailed account that moves from capital to capital, emphasizing the interconnectedness of decisions and the shared responsibility of multiple states. Clark's narrative pays particular attention to the Balkans and to the internal politics of Austria-Hungary, Serbia, and Russia, and it helps readers see how easily misperceptions and fears can feed escalation. For a more synthetic and analytical overview, the work of Jack Levy and William Mulligan is especially helpful. They focus on how structural conditions and individual decisions interact, exploring questions of deterrence, miscalculation, and the role of domestic politics in foreign policy. Engaging with their analysis can clarify the broader theoretical issues at stake in debates over war causation, not just for 1914, but for international relations more generally. These readings, taken together, expose students to different emphases and methods, from national versus transnational perspectives to archival microhistory versus broader analytical frameworks, and to arguments that stress either deliberate design or tragic drift. In a classroom setting, several lines of discussion naturally emerge from this material. One fruitful question invites students to weigh structural forces against individual choices. To what extent do the alliance system, militarism, and nationalism make a general war likely, and to what extent could particular leaders, by making different decisions at key moments in July 1914, realistically have kept the peace? A second discussion prompt asks students to consider the role of military planning and mobilization in constraining political options. How far do detailed war plans and railway timetables limit the freedom of civilian governments? Could any of the major powers have seriously contemplated abandoning or radically modifying their existing plans once a crisis had begun? Or were they, by design, locked into an all-or-nothing logic? A third line of debate encourages students to compare the dynamics of 1914 with patterns in more recent international tensions, without focusing on specific contemporary events. Are there recognizable similarities in the way alliances, arms races, domestic politics, and perceptions of prestige interact? If so, what lessons, if any, should policymakers and citizens draw when thinking about how to manage crises in a world where large-scale war remains possible, even if differently shaped? Reflecting on the failure of European diplomacy in 1914 underscores how fragile peace can be when states place too much faith in rigid plans, automatic commitments, and the presumed shortness of any future war. Alliances can deter aggression, but they can also transmit and magnify local conflicts. Military preparations can provide security, but they can also create pressures to act first before an adversary does. Above all, the experience of the July crisis suggests that leaders need both imagination and restraint. Imagination to see that familiar patterns of crisis may, this time, carry new and more terrible risks, and restraint to step back from options that promise pride or advantage in the short term, but carry catastrophic potential in the long run. Sources. This lecture drew on a mix of classic histories, recent scholarship, and digitized primary documents about the July crisis and the wider causes of the First World War.
Levy and Mulligan, 2021. Why 1914, but not before? This political science article from Rutgers University was central for understanding how long-term structural forces and short-term decisions interacted, and for framing the question of why war broke out in 1914 rather than earlier. Christopher Clark, 2013, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914. Clark's book informed the discussion of the July crisis, alliance politics, and misperception, especially the idea that leaders sleepwalked into war rather than executing a single, pre-planned conspiracy. Fritz Fischer, 1961 to 1967, Germany's Aims in the First World War and Related Works. Fischer's archival research underpinned the section on German war aims and responsibility, including references to the September program and debates over whether Berlin sought a deliberate war of expansion.
Barbara Tuchman, 1962, The Guns of August and Related Military Histories. These works were used for summaries of the Schlieffen Plan, mobilization timetables, and early war strategy, illustrating how military planning and railroad schedules pressured political choices. National Geographic, recent article on the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. This piece provided a clear narrative of the Sarajevo assassination, Gavrilo Princip, and why this single event could ignite a continent already primed for conflict. Online reference articles, including the July crisis entry on Wikipedia from 2023, a recent Grokopedia article on Germany in the First World War, and a fiveable study guide on the July crisis and declarations of war. These sources were used to cross-check dates, basic chronology, terminology, and student-friendly summaries of events like the Moroccan crises and the Balkan Wars. Primary document collections, including the Austro-Hungarian Ultimatum to Serbia, hosted by the Yale Law School Avalon Project, and German diplomatic documents in the University of Wisconsin Digital Collections. These archives supplied the exact wording of the ultimatum, the so-called blank check, and key mobilization and declaration texts quoted or paraphrased in the lecture. Carnegie Endowment Report on the Balkan Wars from 1914. This contemporary investigation of the Balkan conflicts informed the account of nationalism, atrocity, and border changes in the years just before the First World War. British Foreign Office and related national archives on the Moroccan crises and pre-war diplomacy. These document collections were used to reconstruct how earlier confrontations over Morocco and other imperial flashpoints hardened alliances and made crisis diplomacy more brittle by 1914. Thank you for choosing StorySwap.